Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Australian Survivor.
Survivor is a...
Survivor New Zealand.
Survivor.
Survivor.
Losers.
21 South Africans.
12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
Give them the
swimmer.
£1 million.
Million
euro. Million.
Rubli.
Tribe spoke. Tribe spoke.
Tribe spoke. Tribe
spoke.
The adventure of a lifetime.
Hello everyone and welcome to RHAP's coverage of Global Survivor. I am your host Shannon Guss, here to talk about something I find very interesting, something that will continue on our game theory series as we look at examples from all over the world of Survivor and kind of drill down into some theoretical topics. And today we are discussing persuasive psychological principles that you can use or players can use and we can analyze that create strategic success for these players. I know that's a lot. We're going to drill down into it. We have some expertise here. We have an expert. So it sounds like a lot, but hear us out. And by the end of this podcast, you will be an expert in it too. You will have a psych degree. I promise you that. So please welcome a clinical psychologist, someone who is well known to RHAP. You may have recently heard her on RNAP and various other appearances. Please welcome the great Dr. Amanda Rabinovitz. Amanda, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Shannon. I've always really, really enjoyed the approach that you take to Survivor coverage. I think that you're one of the greatest minds in all of Survivor commentariat. So I'm really, really looking forward to talking to you today about some of this stuff.
Thank you for saying that. I mean, obviously, I've been so excited to talk to you because you've done some podcasts in the past with Rob about, you know, the psychology of Survivor, and I think why a lot of people enjoy Survivor and why a lot of our listeners enjoy Survivor is that kind of academic element to it, the pure social psychology of it. And I wanted to kind of find a new angle to use your expertise and drill down into some of these psychological principles and how they're used and how sometimes they're used and we don't even realize it's happening. I know in talking about it, I went back to some examples that at the time I was like, why is this even happening? Why would anyone agree to this deal or something like that? And now, as we've explained it theoretically, and as I've been looking at it, I'm like, wow, we were seeing some of these principles happen in front of our eyes, and now it explains it. So I'm hoping the listeners will get some of that out of it as well and kind of be able to look at Survivor differently in the future and in the past. And if they're going on Survivor, maybe use them to their advantage and manipulate some people with some pure psychology.
I've always wanted to find a way to use my expertise for manipulation for personal gain. So I think that this is going to be great. It's great to be here. Like, as you said, a couple of years ago, I did a podcast with Rob where I was just sort of talking about how social psychology applied to elements of the social game and Survivor. And that was really just more descriptive and kind of talking about all of the different processes that are at play. But I think what you and I are going to talk today is much more focused on zeroing in on the strategic element of these principles and how you can sort of harness this to improve like your persuasive, how compelling your persuasion is and like how some of the best players have actually already, you know, incorporated a lot of these persuasive techniques into their approach.
Yeah, I think that's what I've kind of come to with this game theory series is like, yeah, it's for the people, the listeners, the viewers to analyze the show. It's for people who might want to go on the show thinking about what their strategies will be. But what it is it's very much hardcore strategy. And I think that's what we did with the Harry podcast we did last year, which was on like drilling down on the social game, but it was like using that social game to very like strategic effects. And then with Taryn, we talked about plurality votes, and it was again kind of like, when should you use it? When should you not do it? Like, how can they be effective? So it's kind of in using these different principles or different criteria that we're getting in these different podcasts and just like looking at the hardcore pure strategy element of it for the sake of, again, analyzing and playing the game in the future. But before we get into all of that, you've talked about some of the stuff you've done with Rob. Can you give a little bit of your resume as a podcaster and obviously as a psychologist, and why we're all so lucky to hear from you in this podcast?
Sure. Thank you for saying so. So I'm a clinical psychologist, as you said in my introduction. I have a doctoral degree in clinical psychology with a specialization in neuropsychology. And this kind of social psychology is not within my direct field of expertise, but I did study this in graduate school, and I've continued to remain very interested in these principles and sort of staying on top of them and the literature to some extent. So that's where I come from sort of in my academic and professional life. In my life as a huge Survivor nerd, I've just sort of been a fan since season one. I was fortunate enough to discover RHAP at the very, very beginning when Rob was podcasting about heroes versus villains. So I've just kind of been hanging around in this world. And I think the first time I appeared on a podcast was the Psychology of the Social Game podcast that I did with Rob as one of the summer off-season podcasts. And I think that might have been in 2017. And, you know, since then, I've had a couple of appearances on RHAP, a couple of appearances on Rob and Akiva Need a Podcast. Jason Curtis Rivera and I have been podcasting about the television show Psych. We have just released our 11th episode. So I've gotten more into podcasting definitely during the pandemic. I've really kind of thrown myself into it as a hobby. I've gotten to appear on post-show recaps a couple of times. So just having a lot of fun with that. But like definitely my whole like attraction to this world was really getting into the nitty-gritty of Survivor strategy.
Yeah, I mean, and that doesn't surprise me, because I feel like my interest in like social psychology, and I'm obviously not in that field, but like that's one of the main thing, and like game theory and all of that is one of the main reasons that I love Survivor. And I was talking to a friend of mine who is a psychologist, and about how we're going to do this podcast and what we're talking about, some of the persuasive techniques we were talking about. And she was saying how like that's a big part of like family psychology and like relationship psychology, because it's like how people manipulate each other, and like it's a big part of like toxic relationships. And I was like, yeah, like Survivor is based on toxic relationships, right? Like the people that you bond with in this game where you have to betray each other. So yeah, it's incredibly toxic. So I was like, that doesn't surprise me at all. Like, we need some like relationship counselors to come into Survivor and fix these people.
That's true. Yeah, it's funny, like going through this stuff, I mean, a lot of the principles that we'll talk about today, once we get into it, like they've just been developed to understand like how people relate to each other and process information. But like the places where like they've kind of been like refined and really systematized as techniques is like in sales and business, and like these situations where you're trying to control somebody's behavior, like getting them to buy something or to donate money. So there's definitely a lot of manipulation, but then, you know, people could kind of, so I'm saying we're going to give you a lot of tools. Please use them for good. Use them like having fun in a game. Don't start, you know, manipulating and controlling the people in your lives with them. I'm just going to issue a disclaimer. If you do that, that's at your own risk, and that I do not endorse. We here at Survivor Global, RHAP coverage, do not endorse that behavior.
Yeah, unless you're fighting for $1 million. Or maybe you're in an online game. I mean, there's some place to manipulate people. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know how far I'm going to take the line. I think people can, they can use their discretion.
It gets blurry. It definitely does.
So just to kind of explain to the listeners what we're doing. Firstly, we're pretty much mostly talking about examples here from US Survivor. I know you've seen like bits and pieces of international. I will throw in any international examples that are kind of relevant at the time, but I think we're like 95% on the US, just to kind of let the listeners know what they're in for. And so in this podcast, we've got a few topics that you came up with in terms of persuasive psychological principles. And then we're going to go through the examples from survivor history, the application, the theory. So those are the different roots of persuasion, rational persuasion and emotional, the foot in the door technique, the door in the face technique, and cognitive dissonance as a persuasive tactic. So these are things, again, that may just be words to you right now, but you will be an expert in a couple of hours from now as a listener. So we're going to start with rational or logical persuasion versus emotional. Amanda, can you kind of explain the theory behind that for the people who, like me a few days ago, knew nothing about this type of stuff?
Yeah, sure. So there's this model of persuasion that basically explains that there's two major routes that you can use to persuade somebody. The central route is taking a logical or a rational approach. So this is when you're really like laying out the case for what you want this person to do. And this is going to be like the most effective technique if the recipient of your message is highly motivated to process this information, like they really want to make a good choice, and they have the ability to think about the message. So their ability can have to do with like just sort of how they see the world, like what type of person they are, and it can also have to do with sort of the circumstance that they're in, like how distracted they are at a given time. So this is the most effective way of persuading somebody to do something under the conditions that they're highly motivated and they have the ability to process your message. The other route of persuasion is this peripheral route, which you can think of as really a more emotional type of persuasion. And this is going to be the most effective when the person that you're trying to persuade has little or no interest in the subject that you're persuading them on, and they have some sort of lessened ability to process your message. So when this technique is in play, you're looking at using sort of like mental shortcuts or heuristics, like rules of thumb might be more appealing. The credibility of the speaker or how likable the speaker is going to have more of an impact than the message itself. So this is a theory that kind of outlines what are the different ways that you can persuade somebody and what are the specific circumstances under which one method versus another method is going to be effective.
Yeah, so I think like what I've learned about it in the last few days of my own crash course into the stuff, largely survivor-based crash course. Like now I love that my entire understanding of psychology will be through like pure survivor examples, which is true for me in most things. But I think so we've got the logical thing and we've got some good examples of that in Survivor we're going to talk about. But then like, oh, the central route of persuasion, but the peripheral one, which is like that more emotional one, those are going to be the other tactics we talk about of like, all right, well, if it's not logical, how are you getting someone to where you want to be? How are you kind of manipulating that? And those are going to be some of the other tactics that we talk about. And I think we also have some interesting examples here because a lot of it, as you've said, is like assessing not just the person and what kind of they seem amenable to, but also their specific motivation in that situation. And we have some examples there on when someone kind of maybe acts against type and how they've been analyzed in that situation to, you know, go with a different route of persuasion when you might think that they're like a super logical person, for example. But in terms of like the pure, like the central route, the pure logic and rational, you came out with like such a good example of how this was done in Survivor perfectly. And I don't think it can be beaten. And I actually watched parts of the episode last night to prepare for this, and I was just like in awe of it happening in front of me. And that is Yule convincing Penna to vote with I2 at the merge, which was like a game-breaking vote. Obviously, it's 9 people, 4 versus 4 with Penna in the middle. And I was just so struck by how logical Yule was, perfect logic, almost like some funny logic to a point where it was like so unemotional for me. And Raro, who Jonathan doesn't vote with, is so emotional as well, and like not using any logic, and he doesn't vote with them, even though he kind of wants to. So this was a great example, I thought, of just illustrating that point to a T.
This was the very first thing that came to my mind when I was thinking about like this particular form of persuasion. Like, first of all, like Yule is like this kind of like master of like the logical and rational argument. And he like very carefully lays that out. And he also like very I think he's very aware that he's sort of pegging Penner as being the type of player in the type of position where he's going to be open to that kind of appeal. Like he understands like that Jonathan is a very self-interested player and he recognizes the position that he's in. So I think that this is an example of him being like having a very excellent assessment of who he's directing his message to. And then also doing like a really masterful job in laying out that case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually Penner, like having watched it back, Penner takes that logic to Yul, where he's like, if you have the super idol at the time, just the idol, I guess, you like, I have to work with you because if you were to have it, if I'm on the other side of it, I'll go home. And Yul's like, okay. Then he shows him, I do have it. If you don't vote with us, we'll vote you out. And takes that logic right back to them. And it's so logical to the point where he's like, I would want to sit with you at the end because you have enemies. Like, this is not flattery. This is not, like, appealing right to someone's base instincts. This is, like, and Penner, who's a logical guy, could be like, honestly, that makes a lot of sense. You would want to sit next to me. You're not saying because you like me, you want to spend time with me. Like, you as a logical person, appealing to me, a logical person, that, like, who wouldn't want to sit next to me? So he's, like, so logical in that. And emotionally, like, he doesn't want to be with I2. Like, he doesn't think they're going to trust him again after he mutinied. He just really doesn't want to go home because of the idol. And then Rero on the other side are, like, completely illogical. Even Poverty, obviously one of the best players of all time, is like, there's no way that Yul can have the idol. He was just there for a day. And Penner's like, of course he can have the idol. At the point, he doesn't know for sure. But he's like, it's totally a possibility. Like, it's all so, it's all very much driven by ego for Rero. It's like, you know, Penner doesn't get to come and tell us what to do. We call the shots. Like, we're running the show. I think Nate says, you don't come into our tribe and tell us what to do. Yul's like, you know, the mastermind. He needs to go now. It's all very much like that instinct. And that does not work for Penner. Penner wants to do the logical thing and he doesn't want to go home and he's intimidated. And because of that, I2 will be the final four. And that is how powerful this can be.
Yeah. It's an incredible example of that. And it's like interesting to think about, like, you know, the position that Penner is in and like what, like, you know, when, because you can imagine like Yule's approach, like being risky with a different type of player, right? Like you can imagine that mm-hmm. like feeling like threatening or somebody being like, you're not going to tell me that I would lose in the end. But like, I think it's like the example of Penner being like highly motivated and being the type of player who has the ability to think things through strategically like that, that it really lands with him, whereas it might not have landed with a different type of player.
Yeah, but I do think also that what Yul had on his side was that they did have like the logical upper hand. Like what they were saying did make sense, and Rero being so illogical. So like on the other side of that coin are using some of these techniques to convince people to do illogical things. Obviously there's like a little bit of flawed logic we can talk about as well. But like, for example, I think the one that comes to mind where it's like purely like an emotional persuasion, and something we'll talk a bit about later in terms of cognitive dissonance. But like one of the best things I've ever seen someone convince someone else to do on Survivor is Tony convincing Wu to take him to the end. One of my favorite Wus of all time. And it was again like this, he had to use the techniques of something like cognitive dissonance, of like appealing to, you know, a value system no one was asking Wu to uphold except himself. Of honor and integrity and these things beyond the game that no one cared about except Wu, because he had like created this value system that, this identity for himself that he like needed to stick to. And while I think there might have been some flawed logic there that Tony was appealing to a little bit, like they hate me, they won't vote for me, I do think it was like largely these techniques being used, and we will talk about the specific techniques, but I think that just shows kind of like the opposite of someone like a Wu versus someone like a Penner. You can go to Penner with logic, especially when you actually are being logical, but with Wu, how much is that going to work? Like you mostly have to go and be like, these illogical, emotional things that matter to you are important. And for that reason, like you have to do something that is like purely illogical. And that's why Wu lost the game. So I think seeing kind of like those difference in players and those difference in styles kind of talks to what we're speaking about here.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that. It's interesting. I was trying to think, it's like, I do think that Yul has logic on his side in this case, but like, obviously this doesn't work out for Penner. So did Penner ultimately act in his best interest, or did Yul just lay out a case that appealed to him that wasn't necessarily in, like, was he so masterful that he laid out like a case that appealed to Penner via faulty logic?
I think that the logic still was good, because it got Penner through that night. Like, I don't doubt that if Penner was like, I'm not doing it, that Yule would have taken him out that night. Like, I think he was going to be a man of his word at that point. So it got him through the merge. Also, I don't even feel like Yule was lying a lot here. Like, I think he would have been happy to sit next to Jonathan. I just feel like then some other things happened, and then, you know, he stayed loyal, and they wanted Penner out before them, and Adam said that if he did that, he'd get his jury vote. So things kind of happened down the stretch. Penner's at that point pretty much in a no-win situation anyway. So you're not doing it of, like, what gives him better win potential. At that point, for him, a win is getting to tomorrow, which he does. And I don't think if he went, I mean, obviously they end up voting for Nate, and Penner has a say in that. But I think that if he's, like, very much against Yule, they vote for him, and the idol is used against him, and he does have an idol. So, yeah, it's a hard way. You're in a no-win situation, which is, you know, brings us to the next example. Very similar situation of someone in a no-win situation at a merge between two groups, which is Cochrane. And I found this example really interesting, and it's one that you brought up, because Cochrane, like, seems like he should be a really rational, like, logical person. And for him, I think the logic was to stay with Savai and go to Rocks, but they kind of, like, appeal to the pure emotion of him, like, the emotion of, you don't want to go to Rocks, you're a super fan, like, you don't want your entire game to break on Rocks, and the emotion of, like, you've had the worst pre-merge ever, you've been treated so badly, like, why don't you, you know, come to us, like, a port in the storm, and that's what Coach does. So I think that's what's really interesting, because it speaks to not just assessing the person, but assessing, like, their particular motivations in that situation.
Yeah, I think that this is a great example, because as we were, like, talking through these in service of, like, planning the podcast, I was sort of thinking, oh, it would be really, like, it would be a really good illustration if we could find somebody who acts against type because of the circumstances that they're in. Like, so just to sort of show how it's not just like this is a logical player and this is an emotional player, but that you can kind of assess what situation is a player in. And if you're directing a persuasive argument towards them, you have to be super, super aware of that. And, you know, Cochrane, I guess, was at the bottom of Savai. I guess we'll never know exactly how at the bottom they were going to, you know, potentially be going to Rocks in that vote. The flip was going to certainly put him in the bottom of a polo. So, like, Cochrane is sort of smart enough, I think, to know that the logical, rational argument there would be faulty, right? Like, if Coach goes in and tries to explain to him with a rational appeal why he's in a better position if he flips, like, I think that Cochrane is going to suss that out and immediately reject that. But, you know, Coach sort of correctly identifies that Cochrane is, like, in somewhat of a depleted state, sort of feeling like he's been badly treated by Savai. He also, like, appeals to Cochrane's identity as a super fan, and he, like, sort of, instead of, you know, having him really scrutinize the logic of what he's being asked to do, he appeals through this peripheral route and gets him to make this flip.
Yeah, because I think logically, like, Cochrane is on the bottom of both tribes. Cochrane is going to have a hard time winning this game either way. It's not looking good. But I do think, like, logically, so he screws over Savai. He has lost 6 jury votes. He does end up coming 7th. Like, they vote him out at the last of the Savai from Apollo. And they leave themselves as the final 6. Like, it wasn't a great situation. I don't know if staying with Savai would have been that much better.
I know that that Jim Rice has tried to say that Cochrane was much higher in the pecking order at Savai, but we'll never know. I mean, I guess that, like, it's almost impossible to believe that, like, he wasn't going to be at the bottom of Upolu, so you could say that it was objectively a bad move, but I think that you're right that, like, he wasn't in a great position. So at this point, like, you know, he was the win was probably a foregone conclusion, like, that he wasn't going to be able to achieve it. But this is, like, kind of, I think, commonly accepted to be a mistaken move for him, even though, like, I think people recognize that this wasn't, like, a move that lost him a game that he had in the bag.
No, I think that, like, he should have gone with Savai. I mean, obviously, it couldn't have gone much worse. Like, he is at the obvious bottom of Apollo. That's where he ends up going home. And I think that he's maybe next to some more unlikable people in terms of, you know, other people he could be sitting next to in the finals. If he goes with Savai, he obviously hasn't hurt as many people by not going with Apollo because he didn't offer them anything. Like, he really did, you know, in that one move, piss off more than half the jury by taking out all of Savaii. So I do think logically he should go with them, but I do think it's like a game of inches because he was going to lose. What I do think is the bad move is if you were going to go with Savaii, don't not go because of fear of the rock. Right. Because at that point, Savaii only had three people who could have gone with the rock because they had three immunities with the idol and two immunities that had been won. And it's only like a 1 in 9 chance. Like, if that is the better route for you, which I think we're agreeing that it probably was, at least slightly, maybe more than slightly, you have to go with it even if you're fearful of the rock. And I think that what Coach did really well and what Apollo did really well, and what was probably just inherently in Cochrane, was that he really didn't want to go due to the rock. And I think that is illogical. Like, sometimes you have to take that risk for the better shot for your long-term game. And they just played on that super fandom, that like incredibly emotional thing in him where he dreamt of this his entire life and he didn't want it to end on a rock. And that is illogical. So it spoke against type of Cochrane.
Right. And then I think it's like, just to speak to the psychology of this, it's like there are different factors that are just going to sort of deplete your resources for thinking logically. And this is one of the things that's so interesting about Survivor, is that people are physically taxed, they're emotionally taxed, they can be cognitively very taxed. I know that like Stephen Fishback has talked about how like sometimes you're planning all of these vote splits and like working this out over and over again, and it just kind of melts your brain at some point. It becomes too complicated, given like all the other like elements and stresses that you're dealing with. And like all of those things, all of those different stressors are actually chipping away at your ability to process a rational argument. And I think recognizing that Cochrane was, you know, feeling sort of beat up by his tribe, like feeling like he didn't have a home, like what Coach offered him was like, I'm going to make you feel comfortable by being flattering to you, by making you feel like we like you more than your original tribe does, like we respect you. I'm going to, you know, give you the opportunity to, you know, be with one of your heroes, to wear my jacket. And like all of those things, I think were like wrapping Cochrane in a warm blanket. Mm-hmm. And I think we recognize like how the coach was good at doing that, particularly in the case of Cochrane. But like part of it, I think, was that Cochrane was sort of so spent that at that point, like that comfort and, you know, real like was going to be much more of an effective way of persuading him than actually. I think that if Coach did something very different and tried to make a Yule move of explaining to him like, okay, if you vote with us and you're going to be 4, you're not going to be 7 and this and this and this, like I think that Cochrane that might have actually backfired. And we actually know this from psychology that that sometimes logical arguments can lead to this boomerang effect. And this is what, like, one of the reasons why arguing with people about politics on social media is so bad, because like what if you try to engage somebody in a logical argument when they're sort of dug in, or they're, you know, they're not motivated to process your message for whatever reason, then what they'll do is actually they'll end up turning that around and they'll just work even harder to discount everything you say. And it ends up having them even more dug in their original opinion. And I think that you can see that happen sometimes in Survivor when people, you know, miscalculate and try to go too hard with one of these logical arguments. People will say like, well, you know, I think you're wrong and I'm going to prove to you that I'm going to win with this group instead. So I think the coach really like absolutely gets this right and appeals to Cochrane in the perfect way. And it's one of like the best social moves, I think, of that season that like we can attribute to Coach right there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think like, because if Cochrane and Penn are in a similar role here, I'm just trying to imagine if Coach comes in and is like, I have an idol and if you don't vote with us, you'll go home tonight. Like, I think that while that logically would have made sense, like Cochrane just probably would have curled up in a ball and cried because like he'd already like been through it, and Penner had been through it in the pre-merge, like, you know, the immunity and everything like that. You know, Cochrane had it worse emotionally. But what he was looking for was a port in the storm, and Coach knew to offer that. And like to just come in and be like, hey, you're smart, you wear glasses, you went to Harvard, here are the numbers of how you'll do slightly better with us. And like, that would have not have helped. Or like even going to him and say, I'd like to sit next to you because clearly your whole tribe hates you. Penner was like, fair is fair. Cochrane would have been like, hey, it's been a rough few weeks. Like, maybe take a chill on insulting me. Like, I think coming to him with that warmth it's the opposite approach of Yule, but it worked perfectly for him there. And like, if honestly, if people ask me, what do you love about Survivor, which they often do, given that I've dedicated my life to this, the thing that I often say is that it creates these contradictory things where, you know, we spoke about it with Harry, that you go out there to play optimally at all times, backstab everyone, play it like a game of chess. And everything should be so logical. We'll talk about it later, but your jury vote should be logical. Your move should be logical. And because it's just right. Like, you rely on these people for warmth and food and love and any of your social interaction and winning as a team and all of these things, like, you create these communities that make it so rooted in everything that's not logic, while you're trying desperately to be as logical as you've ever been. And as you've said, you're depleted anyway from the no sleep and you know, no food and everything like that. You're trying to be as optimal, as logical, playing the best game of chess you've ever played. My chess references are going to be a lot. I just finished the Queen's Gambit. But you're trying to do that, and you are in a situation where you are held back from that. And that is the beauty of, like, the contradictory nature of Survivor. So I think some of these show that, because it feels like it shouldn't make sense, but you're, like, primed for it.
And we love it because it's like this heightened real life, right? It's like we're all in these situations, and we're in these, like, you know, we are navigating a social world all the time. We're not as depleted as the survivors are, and we don't have, like, such a clearly defined goal of eliminating people and having $1 million. But, like, I think the reason that it resonates is because, like, we recognize these things as things that we experience ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, an example that you brought up that is kind of, like, in between these things was Amber staying in All Stars, the very famous Rob says to Lex, you take care of her, I'll take care of you if you can. And I kind of wanted to get your take on what was the persuasion here. Like, was it Rob? Because in that sentence, I feel like there's a bit of everything. It is logical because Lex is down in the numbers. Having Boston Rob's power and help at the merge is helpful. If you're going to be a minority anyway, like, yeah, it helps to cozy up to the person who's going to be in charge, which Lex was going to be in the minority at the merge. But then I also think that there's more than that. There's kind of, like, the guilt, the friendship, the emotion, all the things that made Jeff say, like, oh, this is a different game and I'm uncomfortable about it because it's a returnee season. So do you look at that and see it as, like, a logical thing? Or do you look at that and see that Boston Rob was using kind of some other tactics to get Lex to do what he wanted?
Right. It's so interesting to, like, look at this move and to look at, like, how this appeal, like, how this particular appeal resonates with Lex in the game, because I think we could start to, you know, talk about this in the realm of cognitive dissonance too. And so maybe I'll just introduce that concept, because I think it's going to like come up from time to time. But you know, cognitive dissonance is this idea that it's very, very uncomfortable for people to hold these two different beliefs, or to have beliefs and actions that seem inconsistent. And so I bring it up in the case of Lex, because Lex seemed to have this belief that his friendship with Rob transcended the game. But it's so interesting that he doesn't see his friendship with Ethan in the same way, like, that he sort of has, like, he didn't seem to think that all these moves were personal, but he seemed to think that this keeping Amber in the game was personal. But I think that was an example of this emotional appeal that worked with that Rob used effectively with Lex. And I don't know, like, if at the time Rob meant to have this be a gameplay move, or if it was coming from a place of more of vulnerability and wanting to keep Amber in the game. But, like, I think what Rob did really effectively here was he appealed to Lex's identity as a friend. You know, Lex says several times, like, this wasn't about gameplay. This wasn't, like, you as a survivor player asking me as a survivor player to keep your alliance in the game. This was, like, you as a friend asking your friend to, like, keep your girlfriend in the game. And, like, so he really activated this identity in Lex that I think was in Lex's mind was much bigger than Survivor. And I think that's in part why it worked. I also think it worked because there was probably some pregame alliance with Lex and Rob and Kathy, and they thought that this was, like, going to set them up better than it did. But I do think that, like, is an example of this emotional appeal. Like, obviously, Rob ends up turning his back on Kathy and Lex, and that becomes the whole thing. You know, I think that Lex is a rational player, but I do think that, like, he's somebody who takes his, like, his sense of loyalty and what it means to be a friend very seriously. And the way that Rob played that situation is, I think he very much activated that identity in Lex and, like, made that very salient for him. And under those circumstances, Lex couldn't bring himself to keep Jerry over Amber, which probably would have been the better move for the game.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about cognitive dissonance a little later, but, like, something you said really resonated with me in some of the examples I was researching before this, which is, like, the way you do it, like Woo, as we've said, as an example, the way that you can create, you can convince someone to do something illogical with cognitive dissonance is, like, they think what they're doing is bigger than the game. And, like, the truth is, it's not. Like, it's all, you know, you're all just in the game, like, you're not more special than anyone else. And the examples we'll talk about, like, Woo thought that it was all about honor and integrity and it was beyond the game. Like, it's not beyond the game. Just vote out the person who's going to beat you. Like, the objective is to win. And I think, like, if anyone's going to play in the future and someone is coming to you with these, like, value systems that we'll talk about that seem bigger than the game, like, I'm a David. It's about winning as a David. It's not about me winning, or it's important that the heroes or villains win, or that this collar person wins, or whatever, you know, has been told to me by the show or by another player as, like, an extreme value system that's beyond the game. Lex, your friendship, it's beyond the game. And I get that that felt different because it was the first returnee season. But, like, the secret is, future player, it's not beyond the game. Vote out the person who's a threat to you. Like, do what is in your best interest. And I know that's hard at the time. But, like, for any player, if I can just help one person say, wait a minute, no, it's not. I'm not special. This is not different. It is just a game. Then we have done enough in this podcast to help that poor person being manipulated in this way.
Yeah, I think that it's probably easier said than done. But, like, if you can't put that aside for yourself, like, at least recognize how to use it to manipulate other people. I think,
yeah, fair enough.
I think that that might be actually, like, an easier feat, because, I mean, the reason that, like, almost all of these persuasive techniques work, like, one of the underlying drivers of all of them is this idea called self-perception theory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it really has to do with the fact that, like, as human beings, we are so highly motivated to view all of our actions as being consistent with a belief system. Like, it's very important for us to be able to understand the things that we do as reflecting our core beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a little bit of an illusion. Like, I think that there's some evidence that what happens more of the time is, like, we act in the world and then we make up a story for ourselves that's post hoc that explains why all of those actions, you know, line up. And so, you know, this is the reason that, like, this works here on Lex, is that, like, Lex, once you make Lex super aware of, like, his belief that he is a good friend, then, you know, maybe he would have just been able to vote out Amber had he not been thinking this way. And then if somebody confronted him with this later and said, you voted off Amber, you're not a good friend to Rob, then Lex would have been able to tell himself a story of, you know, this is a game. It's bigger than that. I'm doing this for my family. Rob and I will be friends afterwards. All of these things would have been totally reasonable. And I think that Lex would have been able to process that. But because, like, Rob heightened this identity that he has, it made it really difficult for him to act in a way in that moment that was inconsistent with that. And, like, that's just a really powerful tool for getting people to behave the way that you want them to behave.
Yeah, so it's about getting that belief system in there before they take the action. Because I think what you're saying is that, like, so someone will do an action, and if you can kind of change their beliefs beforehand, you can manipulate what that action is. But if they just do the action, then afterwards, they can rationalize it to themselves, which then wouldn't help you because they didn't do what you wanted to do. So it's kind of getting in there beforehand to try and change what they're doing.
Right.
And with that in mind, I wanted to get to one of these techniques, which is the foot in the door technique. So you can explain, like, to the listeners, like, what the specific technique is doing in manipulating people before they do the action so that they do what you want them to do.
Yeah, so the foot in the door technique is, it kind of works through this, exactly like you just said, Shannon, it works through this idea that, like, once somebody has acted in a certain way, then they're going to be forced to sort of rationalize that to themselves. So what foot in the door does, and it kind of comes from like this concept of sales, is like the salesperson just kind of getting their foot in the door. You start by asking for like a very small request. So it could be, you know, something like, you know, can I borrow your pencil, or, you know, something that's very small and reasonable. And then what, once somebody says yes to that, you can follow that up with a much bigger request, and it's much more likely to be successful. And the reason for that, like I said, is that, like, you know, once somebody has complied with you, then they sort of start to think of themselves as like, oh, you know, I must have done that because this person is a good person. Like, one of the examples is like, if you just sort of donate a small amount of money to a charity, then they might ask you over time, like, okay, well, now will you agree to become a sustaining member and make this like a monthly contribution? Or, you know, this is like the sort of like free trial period of like, you know, your streaming service or whatever. It's like, once they get their foot in the door, then you're much, much more likely to agree to larger asks in the future.
Yeah, and you gave a great example of this, which was like Sarah exchanging jewelry with Brad and Troyzan, which is like, we've done this small thing, and now like we've, like, as you said, like agree to something and then establish it long term, which is a good one. And something that just crystallized for me was that I was like, I've never understood why these moves are always a big deal and seem, you know, like such a game changing thing when they're not. And those moves are something like, all these winners who win with the same pathway of being like the last remaining minority member who slips through, has a lot of love on the jury and wins. And they do that often early on by voting against their alliance member, even when it doesn't make the majority. There's so many examples, like Chris and Vanuatu votes for Sarge, Danny votes for Gary Hogaboom, Vesepia voted for Boston Rob at the merge, Bob didn't vote for Randy but gave him a fake idol, and Michelle voted for Julia. And I remember, like, at that Julia vote, like, the whole drama around it was like, what would Michelle do? And I was like, why is this a big deal? Like, Julia's gone. Like, the majority is on her. Like, who cares if Michelle does or not? We're making it 4-3, 5-2. Like, who cares? Or whatever the votes came out as. And now, as you explain that to me, I'm like, okay, I get that. I get why, like, the resume of these people is that they all did this and then won. And I get that this theoretically makes a lot of sense, because while it doesn't seem like it should make sense, they get their foot in the door by doing this little thing, which has really no strategic consequence. But then they're like, hey, I worked with you. And now they're in a little bit. And I think the success rate kind of speaks for itself. And I now kind of understand what a social move this is, when I didn't really see the relevance of it before.
Yeah, I think that this is a really cool lens, like, through which to look at this type of vote. Because, like you said, these moves have very little strategic consequence. It's a very low stakes thing. Like, they tend to be like this extra vote to pile on that doesn't actually flip anything. But I think that this goes a long way towards explaining what, like, we've identified as like good social games in players like Danny or Michelle, that like helps us understand, you know, what it was that they're doing that might not have like come across on screen. And it's like this very small way of demonstrating loyalty that like creates this link that that then ties them to the alliance and allows them to stay in there and gives them like a foot, like you said, like the foot in the door to be to go deep into the end game. And, you know, because of this principle of like, once you've done something together as a group, like, all of a sudden our big rational brain starts to get to work to understand why we're doing that. And we start to think like, oh, well, these are the people that we can work with. And, or maybe this person is my friend, or maybe like, this is somebody that I'm going to work with in the future. So like, just having had success working together in the past, even if it was in a low stakes, like low consequence way, is now like creating this pathway that will enable that person to do more with that alliance in the future, and also is probably endearing them to those people, making them feel more like, making them more likely to vote for them if they're on a jury.
Yeah, and when you said that, you know, if you work with someone one time, you're more likely to work with them again. Like, things come to mind for me where I feel like this principle is good for pretty much anyone in the game, because fluidity behooves almost everyone. Like, only one person can win. Even if you're in a majority, that majority has a pecking order. Are you at the top of that pecking order? Are you at the top with people you could win against? Like, it's good to shake things up. And even just doing, getting a foot in the door as a minority, or even offering it as a majority, like Tony has done, we've spoken about so many times in 40, often in Kageyama with Spencer. If you do it as a minority, like Tom and Colby did when JT just wanted to vote out Suri, so they just got out that threat. But then, you know, a injury to James and emerge later, like Colby's at the final five. So I think, like, anytime right. you can buy time or kind of establish a little bit of a bond or just shake things up a little bit, you just never know where that's going to go. So, like, I think, like, kind of extrapolating this principle, I think what you would say is, like, make that small move. Like, it doesn't have to be the perfect move. Like, if someone's, like, not, like, I'm not flipping to you fully, but I will, like, entertain this for this vote, I think, like, do it. Because I think, like, obviously everything's situational, but, like, I think flexibility has helped so many people. I mean, another example that comes to mind, like, Aubrey and Sydney working with Michelle and Julie to take out Debbie, which we spoke about on the Plurality Vote podcast. But even, like, something like that, kind of just, like, establishing that small thing, even though they don't end up working together after that, you know, for the next major votes, they all buy time to get their objective. You know, Michelle and Julia get to play the middle a little more. Aubrey and Sydney get a little bit more time to work out how to deal with the super idol threat. So just, like, those small little wins of establishing these things can help in so many ways in Survivor. And I think we see that often. It just takes, like, one tiny break to kind of get away. So I would encourage anyone playing in the future to go with that.
Yeah, and one thing that, like, this thought of, like, how this is a way to keep the game more fluid. Like, I remember listening in Christian's retrospective after David versus Goliath mm-hmm. about, like, mm-hmm. and he described this, like, not really in terms of, like, this social psychology principle, but more in terms of, like, of the entropy of the game, and basically that in his mind, if, like, the game was about, you know, these very rigid alliances that had a pecking order within them, that he was afraid that that would not be a game that would be conducive to him doing well, that he would be identified as a threat and he would be taken out, and that, like, so that in his mind, that, like, the game that would be much more amenable to his success would be one of these games where there was more fluidity. And I think that, like, and this is sort of you also can think of, like, in Cambodia when, like, Stephen is talking about the voting blocks, or, you know, whatever that might be, like, that there, I think that there is something to this notion of these players who are willing to show their willingness to work with somebody one vote at a time that creates sort of many, many more options than a game where you have, like, two groups that are going against each other and then the group with four players is going to win. So players who can leverage that because they're either in the out group or can leverage that because they recognize that that's a game that might be better for their chances. I think it's a really smart thing to do.
Yeah, because if you're so threatening, like someone like Christian, you can't sit there because, like, a sitting duck, because even if you're in the majority, like, eventually they will come for you. But also if you're in the minority, like, they're going to pick you off too. So you really have to be, like, in the complete middle sweet spot where you're, like, the one person who's going to win in this permutation to just kind of sit with it. Everyone else should be making plans. And I think someone who kind of embodied that, even though she, I don't know, it wasn't really persuasive techniques because it was very individual and very strategic, but I feel like she kind of embodied the energy of what we're saying was Natalie Anderson down the stretch of her win, where she was just doing these little wins, like, to get in strategically, like pretending she didn't know that she was meant to vote for Keith so Alec goes home, and then she has Keith on her side, and then Keith is there as a pawn to use. I'm very much in Queen's Gambit mode, you know, so she can take out John Mish, and then at the final five, like, she is slated for a final three with Missy and Baylor, but not if Keith wins immunity at the final four, which is a distinct possibility, so she takes out Baylor with the idol, and then at the final four, she's not even an option to go home. She's not even one of the first two options, which are Keith and Missy. So she set herself up with these small little strategic moves for every contingency, even contingencies that didn't end up happening. Like, Keith didn't win at Final Four, but even if he had, Missy would have gone home. So she just set herself up, and it's one of my favorite stretches of play, and it's one of my favorite end games. And I think it does embody this idea of, like, yeah, she like was constantly just putting the door ajar, and then it was wide open for a win.
Yeah. No, it's like, It's definitely, I agree. It's one of like the most brilliant end games, I think, in like the whole history of the game. And it's actually like a style of play that I think is super unique. Like, I don't think we've seen anybody win quite in the way that that Natalie did. And it's something I've like very much struggled with trying to think of, like, how do you characterize what she did? And she definitely did a mix of like using immunity wins and immunity idols and social relationships, like harnessing all of those things to put herself in the best position. But I definitely think that this foot in the door principle is like very key to understanding her success. And as you were talking about that, Shannon, because we've talked a little bit about this in preparation for the podcast, but now I'm just thinking about how, like, for Natalie being one of the last people who was a single out of the couples, like, mm-hmm. this was an incredibly important move for her to recognize. Like, she's not going to break up these couple. Like, this was like a very unique game in San Juan del Sur because it was blood versus water, and because we had like intact pairs get so deep in the game, and I think that there was like there were super alliances of these intact pairs. And Natalie, like, being somebody who lost her partner so early on, was in this, and then lost her kind of number one ally thereafter, like, was in this very unique position where she was never going to be like part of this dominating group because she was at this disadvantage being just a single person left in the game. So I think that, like, she had foot in the door with, you know, Missy and Baylor and with John and Jacqueline and with, you know, Keith. And like, it's just, she had all of these options at her disposal. So then when she got these tools, like an idol or one immunity, she could really like leverage them in so many different ways. Whereas I think if she was like, had just embedded herself and said, like, I'm going to be the three with Missy, like, I'm going to be Missy and Baylor's third, or I'm going to be John and Jacqueline's third, like, she wouldn't have had all of that room to play.
Yeah. She used it so creatively. And I think it was just those like little moves and, yeah, strategic out of the box thinking. And that's someone who's in a majority who's not happy with necessarily the way the majority is going to shake out, either like who they're going to sit next to at the end, or they even make it to the end in the pecking order, and it's like reshuffling the deck to work with different minority members to make a better situation for themselves. Because we've spoken a lot about this from the minority's point of view. Like, you know, as we've said, voting against an alliance member to kind of get in there, and another thing they do often is, you know, even just vote against each other. If the vote's being split on the two of you, voting against each other, which is like this cruel thing to do just to try and make it through the night, which is something Alex Angarita created in Survivor Fiji, only to immediately go home. But it was a valiant attempt, and he did survive that one night. But I'm interested in, like, how does this work from the opposite side? Because when I'm thinking about, like, especially a move like that, okay, two people are voting against each other in a split vote, which behooves them to get through that night. Who knows, someone like Spencer did it against Shireen. You know, the numbers shake out a certain way, and then they swapped and he is in the final three eventually because buying time is so important. But then I think the majority, by convincing people to do that, by saying like, hey, just vote with us, they surely benefit from that too. Because we talked in the Plurality Vote podcast about how, you know, majority leaves room for insurrection when they split the vote. A third group could come up and get a plurality and vote against them, but not if people are voting against each other. And then they've kind of neutralized that threat because obviously none of them are getting votes. You've convinced a minority to vote against each other, either to save themselves or to show loyalty to you. So in the way that like we're being marketed to, but by the minority getting their foot in the door to kind of infiltrate the situation, how is the majority looking back at that and saying, well, actually also we're getting benefit because we're not getting voted against and we're controlling you? Like, who has the upper hand in that situation?
Right, right, right. I think it's like really interesting to think through these moves from like, I mean, this is one of the like, this is why it's so complex and such a rich thing to analyze, because you can think about these things from everybody's perspective. And, you know, oftentimes, like, even if you're in a stable majority, you know, there's a pecking order within that alliance, and there's some members of that majority who would, you know, be better placed in like having some players in their pockets or somebody from the minority that they could pull in to switch up the dynamics and make sure that they end up at the top. So, you know, I think that that's really interesting to think of. You talked about Tony using Spencer sort of in that way. And I also think we see Tony, I mean, I think this is something that Tony does really well, is like have a, you know, foot in the door with a number of different players. Like he did this with Jeremy, and I think that it like it helped protect him in Winners at War. We talked about how, you know, Natalie was not at risk in that vote where Alec, Christy ends up going home, but she decides that Keith is going to be, you know, somebody that like, so I don't think we would describe this as like Keith Nail's move, but like, you know, that Natalie ends up, you know, creating that bridge and using that because she recognizes that Keith is going to be a player that's more useful to her getting to the end of the game than Alec Christie would be. So I definitely think that there's examples of players who are in the majority position who go to a minority alliance member and then try to use a foot in the door technique of saying like, okay, you show my loyalty here, I'll pull you in, and then I can use this to shake up my group and put myself at the top.
Yeah, I think possibly like initiative is big in that. Like obviously like Natalie was the one making that move and she literally did it alone. Like Keith did nothing. But even like the fact that I feel like it really was like Tony deciding to make that move more than it was like Spencer infiltrating the majority. But I do think in some of these situations, it's like to the victor go the spoils. Like in some situations, it's like you get the person to vote against their ally. They're crying. It's sad. And then you immediately vote them out. In which case, like, they've just kind of been fooled. Like, they've been desperately trying to get a foot in the door, and you were just kind of playing them, and then you vote them out. And in that case, you just kind of neutralize any threat against you, and the majority is the winner. And I hate to be results-oriented, but, like, maybe there is a little bit of, like, assessing it. Sometimes the majority have a blind spot. You get someone to vote with you. All these winners we just described, these, like, underdog winners from the minority
right
to the end. But no, they're secretly infiltrating you. You're the one who has your back turned to it. They're actually winning. It's their move and like they're duping you. So I don't think it's results oriented as much as it's like, how much are you assessing someone? If a majority comes to you and is like, vote with us and we'll help you, and are lying, and you can't tell that and would be better off kind of trying to, if you could, mount like a coup against them, sorry to use like the word of the week, but like, then that's the majority duping you into doing what they want. Whereas like, if you're a minority member who comes to someone and is like, I'm willing to do this for you, and they're like, fine, vote against your ally, whatever. But then they actually have kind of made inroads, and then they go on to win. Like, you're the one who didn't look out for it enough. So I do think there is a bit of, like, who is lying to who is assessing that the best, and kind of who ends up getting the upper hand in that, like, struggle.
Yeah, and we're always limited by what we actually see. Like, I definitely think that they, like, hype things up when it's part of a winner's story, even if it wasn't necessarily, yeah, like, they were the ones responsible for the move. But like, I definitely think that we have seen in the history of Survivor, like people doing it from both positions. And like, I think that that's really who you want to give the credit to, right? Like, is somebody coming, as a minority tribe member, kind of like, is the minority alliance member going to the majority alliance member and like saying, okay, I'm willing to do this. I see the writing on the wall, make sure that it's this person instead of me. And like, I think we see people doing that much more actively. But sometimes I do agree that it's probably hard to suss out, and we just kind of have to look at the best we can do is look at, you know, how it shook out in the end.
Yeah, for me, I hate not being able to, like, nail down the stuff into neat little boxes, you know? Like, that's the way I was, like, whose move was it? But, like, often Survivor is very much, like, everyone was kind of doing their own thing, and, like, a lot of people were doing good things, and it's hard to kind of really assess, like, who was fully in control of that without being super results-oriented about it. But I definitely think there's a lot of benefit there for pretty much anyone in the game.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry. Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And speaking of something very similar that, you know, you can explain to the listeners, which was something I had kind of heard of in theory, but didn't know was like a specific persuasive psychological principle, which is something that you call what is called the door in the face technique. Can you explain to the listeners what that is?
Sure. I sort of like your name for it. Shannon calls this the jet ski technique.
Yeah, but can anyway, I just say that so the reason I call it the jet ski technique is because in my mind it's like, you know, when you ask your parents for a jet ski and they say no, and then you ask them for what you really want. And I don't know for the life of me why that's something in my mind. Like, I try to Google it. Am I quoting something? Is it just something that, like, my family have always said? Is it something that I just have said? I don't think it's something that exists. If anyone has ever heard of this, like, just ask your parents for a jet ski, which is like the typical ridiculous thing they'll never get you. And then ask, is this anything? Okay, someone tweeted me if they've ever heard of this, but I'm calling it the jet ski technique.
This might be a Shannon Gust original.
I want it to be because I don't know where it comes from, and I feel like I'm happy to coin it, but it's so random.
Do you really want a jet ski, Shannon?
No, but the whole point is like you don't really want the jet ski. It's just that your parents will be like, "That's ridiculous. I'm not getting that for you," and you'll be like, "Okay, oh, fine. I'll just have, you know, whatever you actually want." No one, like, your parents are never going to get you a jet ski. That's insane. No.
Well, I think you've actually explained it perfectly in the course of that.
Okay,
there
you go. Jet ski technique for the win.
Yeah, but just in general, this is just the idea that you start off with a really big ask that you don't expect to get, and then what that does is it sort of anchors the person that you're talking to mind that, like, okay, well, that is like the upper bound of what I'm willing to do. And then when you come down with like a much more reasonable request, they're more likely to grant it because it seems like nothing compared to the jet ski.
Yes, the jet ski. I love this. I know I came up with it, but like, I'm also just like, what am I even talking about? Because when you said it, I was like, oh yeah, the jet ski technique. And you're like, what? I like the jet ski. Yeah. And I feel like there were so many, again, things in this when I looked at examples that like crystallized for me, things I didn't understand before. And now I understand they were being manipulated by the jet ski technique.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. One of the things that we, this is really cool. And I was, I think I was talking to you right before we started recording, but like with a lot of these like psychological principles, I think like sometimes you'd explain them and they sound like they make so much sense that people are like, well, of course. And then I wonder, it's like, oh, is this obvious or is this actually adding anything insightful to the discussion? But I do think it's useful when you actually start to drill into examples and you can see like, oh, this actually does explain something in a deeper way than I might have necessarily recognized at first. So I'm glad that seemed to be the experience for you and hopefully for the listeners as well. I think that the most common example in Survivor that we identified that fits this this general principle is when you start by trying to take out like the leader of an alliance. And then you end up with a concession of taking out another player who is still within that alliance that will weaken that target player, but seems like a much easier lift than actually going after the figurehead of the alliance.
Yeah, and I think that this is a good move because, again, like it's like another form of strategic compromise that will get you nearer to your goal without it being like, I think in a lot of these instances, like people really actually do want the jet ski. But it's like too hard. And also in saying that, you say that, have people thought about this before? Like, I'm someone who obviously thinks about Survivor a lot and obviously had the jet ski technique in like the recesses of my mind and had never kind of put these things together. So I hope the listeners as well are like, oh yeah, that like psychological thing that I kind of half think about. That I didn't realize that had, you know, so much stake in Survivor. But I think that it's helpful in Survivor because, yeah, getting that little bit in, or just getting something near to what you want is often enough to grab some power or like shake up the game, or as we've said, buy time, or like it doesn't have to be like the stubborn first choice all the time. Like it's okay to settle for things and have it kind of create a pathway for you where then you can take out what you want. And often when you don't take out the leader, sometimes they go immediately next in some ways. We'll talk about maybe there are reasons you couldn't take them out. Sometimes it does weaken them and give you more power, and that's all that you needed at that time. And the example that I was looking at last night, I feel like we literally saw this in motion. It happens a lot when it's like, oh, we want to vote out the alpha guy, but he helps us in challenges and around camp. Oh, we'll vote out his girlfriend. You know, like weaken the showmans by taking out the girl, which happens often. And like, so when Chelsea went instead of Dean, just like look at the way that this was set out. At the time, I was like, why did Chelsea go home? Like, she was barely even an option before like the very, very end. And she was aligned with the girls. Elizabeth and Elaine were the swing votes. It was like, why would they even go for this? So what it was that Karishma was the presumptive vote. Miffy and Aaron pitched Dean. People didn't like that at all. They were like, Dean was bad in challenges now, but he could get better later. He's like central in the tribe. Like, they want Karishma gone. They hated this pitch. It was very much going to be Karishma. But Dean had been offered as something they were willing to do. They were willing to do that big a move against Dean. Then Miffy pitches Chelsea. And at this, again, as I said at the time, I was just like, why would this work? Like, it makes no sense. Right. Like, Chelsea wasn't even on the table. But I think now, having you explained it to me, this principle, it's like, okay, they've set the boundaries of, like, we would go as far as Dean, and then, like, Chelsea seemed like an okay compromise. It was fine for Missy and Aaron because they weakened the showmass, which is what they'd wanted to do. They got their way. They got some power. And everyone else was, like, manipulated and doing this thing they didn't want to do because it was slightly less ridiculous than the Dean vote, which was, like, an insane pitch in and of itself. And while I didn't understand that, I'm like, now I get it. It was pure manipulation in motion.
Yeah, that's a really, really cool example, and like not one that I necessarily would have thought of off the top of my head. But like, I think that I'd have to go back. I mean, you just watched it, but like, I think that going after Chelsea was probably the better move, right?
Well, and Dean became something different. Dean's his own thing. But Chelsea was a massive threat, and she did have an idol. But like, I think just in perception, like Dean maybe seemed like the bigger move at the time. I don't know.
Right. But I wonder, but like, I think it just shows the power of like doing that kind of like switch up. And it's like people probably spent so much energy evaluating like the merits of the Dean vote that once Chelsea gets thrown out there, they're not going to like scrutinize that argument so much and say like, oh, OK, well, that's better than Dean, who's presumably going to be good in these challenges.
The way that like, I mean, Dean had his own connections. He could have been good in the challenges. Chelsea was more connected in many ways on the tribe, I think. I think if it had worked the opposite way, it honestly could have worked. Like if they'd gone and been like, not Karishma, Chelsea, it would have been like, are you insane? Like how are we going from like the most obvious vote to something so crazy? And then maybe if they'd offered Dean after that, like Dean would have gone home. Like that's genuinely how I feel this manipulation worked out, that it was like, once it kind of been set up and absolutely refused, they were like, well, we don't really want to fight the next option. So Dean had his merits for keeping him around. Chelsea definitely had her merits for keeping her around. They were both kind of threats and helpful in their own way. But I just genuinely feel that, like, you're right. Like, the emotional energy of just rejecting the first one, like, the second one was done for. And I think if it had been the opposite way, like, maybe Chelsea is in the finals and Dean is gone at that point.
Yeah. Well, that would be a very different season.
It would be.
Probably.
I feel like that would be somehow... I mean, I like Dean, but I would have liked that. I like Chelsea a lot. And there's so many prominent examples of this in terms of the showman, like taking out Elise to weaken Aussie in South Pacific, who has his own relationships and who is obviously Aussie, who you're never getting rid of in like a pre-merge unless it's to specifically get him back from Redemption Island. So, it happens a lot in upsetting ways where often the person we maybe like better, the deputy or the woman in the showman is taken out. It's very upsetting.
One of the things that I think is like the best example of like this kind of move that we talked about, and like I don't know how much this like made a difference in that vote, but looking at Heroes versus Villains, when Coach won't vote against Boston Rob, but like he also like throws away his vote. Where does he vote in that?
He votes for Courtney, so he even votes against, like, not even for someone on Rob's side. But it's completely irrelevant because it ends up being a plurality vote with Rob going home, I think, 4-3-1.
Right. So it's like the jet ski ask is like Coach flip on Rob and he's not going to do that. But then what he agrees to do is like functionally going to give you the same outcome. But it's like for him, he feels like it's a concession and it's more reasonable than actually voting against Rob.
This is like, we're going to talk about cognitive dissonance a bit more. And like, this to me is like such an example of that. It's like, coach can't vote against his morals. He gave Rob his word. It's bigger than the game, like honor and integrity. Oh, he can't like vote him out, but he can throw his vote so that Rob goes and sees the exact same result, which somehow is more honorable. Or as Rob would say, you're a little man, coach. I mean, it's clearly like, I actually have my notes here. It's actually much more pathetic. Yeah, his word isn't sacred. If you're going to take the shot, just take the shot at Rob in the game. But yeah, not voting for him and voting for Courtney does absolutely not count as keeping to that irrelevant word if it's something you care to keeping.
Yeah, no, it's but like this is like, and I think, and this is like the most prominent example because it has that super dramatic moment, and it's between like Coach and Rob, who are like, you know, such characters in the game. But like, I think we see this like from time to time where you can't get a player to vote against their ally, but you can get them to effectively throw their vote away, and that like the I think that the reason that that's effective is because of this like door in the face jet ski technique, whereas like you start by asking them for something that they're not willing to do, and then you get them to do something that they also that they wouldn't have been willing to do, but it seems much more reasonable given it's not this extreme measure of actually casting a vote against their ally.
Yeah, and it is the kind of thing where if you say like, hey coach, will you vote so that Boston Rob goes home? I don't know, like that seems like a lot. But when it's coming down from, will you vote out Boston Rob, which was like a clear no, then like maybe, like it's better than that at least in coach's mind. I don't actually think it is, but in coach's mind it is.
Yeah, you change like the like this is this notion of anchors that like people kind of create this framework of like, okay, well this is the most extreme thing and this is the least extreme thing. So like the jet ski or like the voting out your ally or whatever it is, like you just want to create something that like sets that boundary like as high as possible so that whatever you can get them to agree to do will actually also further your strategic aim. So I think that that's like the really effective way to use this technique. Like, of course you don't want to like ask people to do things that are, you know, going to cause them to like just reject you and not want to talk to you. But I think that there's a really effective way to use this strategy.
I do think as well that like Boston Rob is a perennial survivor jet ski, like voting him out is that, because like it happens so often. Like it was a running joke in season 40 that every pre-merge vote was just to get at Boston Rob, and they like couldn't vote out Boston Rob for various reasons, including he wasn't even on that tribe. So like they voted out Amber and they voted out Tyson, and then like on the other tribe they voted out Ethan, which got at Boston Rob without actually like severing the relationship that he had. Boston Rob is a jet ski. I think that's what we've learned over an hour into this podcast.
He's the survivor jet ski.
Yeah, anyone who has listened to this podcast now knows what it means when we say Boston Rob's a jet ski, and that's what you get for investing in Game Theory podcast.
It's literally carrying his family on his
jet ski back. Yeah, I think like there is a lot of times where like just structurally the leader can't go, or like the jet ski or the person you want can't go. Like as we said, Boston Rob was on a different tribe. It's more than just like not wanting to do it, but sometimes it's literally impossible. You know, like for example, Amy in Vanuatu had immunity, so they vote out Leanne. Edgardo, they took him out in Fiji because they didn't know who would have the idol between Alex and Mookie, so they just kind of went for that third option, which was a brilliant move, which I always love to see people kind of work around it in that way. And I think that seeing how it happens when you literally can't do it and take that compromise shows how effective it is, because in those situations, Amy does go next up to Leanne. Edgardo goes, and then it is Mookie and then Alex. So I think by just kind of like taking a shot at the ship, if you can't take out like the captain of the ship, either because they are literally like immune or not there, or because you can't convince people to do it, I think these kind of results do show that if you just kind of forge that pathway, you will end up getting a lot of the time the result that you want. So it's a valuable thing to do.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is also really interesting, because I think it shows like how you can actually like leverage a protected player to make a move that you want to happen. Right. So it's like maybe Boston Rob is not available because he's on the other tribe. But if you build him up as a jet Lucky. If you like build him up in the minds of the other players as the target that of course you want to jet ski, of course you want to take him out, then it's going to make them much more likely to want to, you know, go for these other players that are going to sort of further them on towards that end. So like, I think that even when you're talking about like the player that's the big target that has immunity, there could still be strategic value and sort of like talking about how like, oh, this person is such a big threat, therefore like we can't get the jet ski, you have to go and get this you know, lower value target, and that, and if you kind of set up that argument right, I think that you can you know, really help control the vote that way.
Yeah, because like even if, as an example, like taking out Tyson in the season 40 pre-merge, they're about to swap. They didn't want the threat of having Tyson on a different tribe against them. Tyson is, as everyone was in season 40, but he was super threatening in his own right. But then like attaching him to Boston Rob, who you can't get to because he's like on the other beach, even more so is like, got to take the shot. And I think that probably is helpful in making it even more obvious that he has to go, even though it's a really big move to do it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, we've got to now cognitive dissonance, which is obviously something we've spoken about quite a bit here, which you have explained. And yeah, I think that we wanted to talk about this in terms of both like the votes and how to kind of control votes, but then also, like, for me, it's fascinating in terms of the jury, so we'll definitely talk about both. Before we get into the examples, is there anything else you wanted to add on top of the explanation you've already given?
I do want to add, like, just a little bit more because... you know, so we've talked about what cognitive dissonance is, but there's like specific ways that you can use it as a persuasive technique. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, sort of four steps that you want to go through. So like first, you just need to discover and identify a belief. Like this is going to work better if you're harnessing a belief that somebody already has. Like, so if somebody sees themselves as religious or like with Wu sees himself as very honorable, or identifies as like blue collar or whatever it is, like you want to like identify that attitude or belief that they already hold dear, and then you want to get them to commit to that, like preferably in public. So it's like you kind of get them to agree, like, oh yes, like of course, I'm a Christian and we're all going to pray together. Like get them to display that in a way where it's obvious to other people. That kind of puts them on the hook more as, you know, following through with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you have that commitment, you want to create this experience of dissonance by showing them that they're not, acting in a way that's consistent with their belief system. And then the persuasion sort of swoops in when you like offer them a solution. So you can say like, oh, you know, you're a good Christian and you know, obviously a good Christian would like stick with the group that they were loyal to. And, you know, you're considering flipping on me right now. But like, you know, what you can do instead is you can vote with me and then you'll show your family that you're da da da. Like mm-hmm. You kind of create with them like this way of reconciling whatever's making them uncomfortable so that they can sort of restore this belief that that they're acting in a consistent way with their values.
Yeah, and I think what I find really interesting about this is how players can create like these cult-like kind of groups and communities. We talked a lot about in this podcast, like Boston Rob and Coach creating like that group, like you can't betray them because again, it's bigger than the game. And even just like naming alliances or roles in alliances and creating something that feels very tangible, I think it is a good thing for that because you're portraying something like so real, it will like break in front of you. But I'm also so fascinated the way the show itself does this by putting players into these like tightly defined, but like totally random groups. And then they see players like become attached to these monikers. David versus Goliath was such a major one in that. I remember Rob and I doing the voicemails for the premiere, just cracking up laughing about how completely random it was. Like there was no science to it. Like some people were Davids, I guess, and some were Goliaths, I guess, that easily could have been mixed up. Like it was the kind of thing.
You don't agree that like a lawyer is obviously a David and a real estate agent is obviously a Goliath?
I mean, because it made sense. And the best part about it, what was so funny was that Jeff was like completely committed to the bit of like, yeah, like there's right. A sign. And I remember he said like, you can go from a David to a Goliath, but not from a Goliath to a David. It's like all of this is meaningless, Jeff, but like incredible that you've committed to it so much. there was so many things. Like, they put people into, like, collars. They put people into heroes, healers, hustlers. Is this any way that people have defined themselves before? Then, like, even, like, something like, so it's like heroes versus villains, I think, is a great one. Because, like, it was great for TV because it gave the villains license to be, like, completely devious, like, even right. more so. But then someone like Candace, I think what it was that, like, Parvati was meant to be a hero and Candace was meant to be a villain because she mutinied, but then they didn't right. want Parvati with, like, all of the Micronesia people. So for pure structural reasons, they swapped them. I think they even had different color clothes and they swapped them. And Candace would mutinied, but who is a frontline health worker and an actual hero. But she gets put into the heroes. It didn't make sense.
She is a hero.
Yes, she is. And they were before their time putting her in that tribe. But Parvati, who definitely should have been a villain, gets put in the villains. But then when Candace betrays the heroes, it was like, I remember Rupert being like, oh, she's not a hero. It's like, yeah, she literally wasn't a hero. But for like structural reasons, and they didn't want Parvati being with James, Amanda, and Sari. They put her in the heroes.
Right.
It was meaningless, but now it's this big thing. Like, you want a hero. She's not. Like, none of these things make any sense.
Yeah, no, it's very funny. And, like, not all of these, like, things I think end up hitting and resonating. Like, I do think that they work the best when they do, like, appeal to some aspect of, like, that person's identity that's like already there. And, like, I think a good example is, like, with David versus Goliath, I do feel like you saw it, like, it coalesced for the Davids. And I think it's because, like, there's something that's, like, very sort of flattering about thinking of yourself as, like, being this. Like, I think that many, many more of us, like, are prone to see ourselves as, like, I'm this little guy who's struggling and with, like, hard work and gumption, like, I'm going to, you know, best all of these obstacles in my life and, like, end up on top. Like, I think that that is a narrative that, like, fits with the way that people see themselves navigating through their lives much more than, like, I'm a Goliath and everything was handed to me. And, like, I'm this great Titan that, like, crushes everything in my life. Like, I think that one of the reasons that that season, like, ended up being compelling is because, like, the Davids did kind of internalize and take on that identity. And I think it, like, did probably affect, like, the way that they played together and their commitment to each other. And, like, even in this way where I think, like, they were just sort of rooting for a David to win because it was like a win for all Davids, where, like, I don't think that the Goliaths, like, had that same sense. So I think it's really where it's like something like I'm a healer or a hero or a hustle. Like, I feel like that season was one where the labels didn't, like, really drive the narrative or seem to affect the players on, like, the same level as some of the other divisions have.
I think it depends who you are. Like, someone like Ben, who is a Marine, like, he like, you know, really does kind of, like, encapsulate that, like, I'm a hero kind of thing. Whereas, like, Hustler, what is that? You know, do some of these people who just have regular jobs see themselves as hustlers? Like, definitely not. Like, Hustler was very much like the Hufflepuff, where it was like, we don't really know where to put you. You're not like in healthcare or healing, like, you're not, like, in a heroic profession.
Right.
Did Alan Ball see himself as a hero? Like, probably not, but, like, Ben did. Did Chrissy see herself as a hero? Some made more sense than others individually, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. But any of these things that, like I said, are, like, activating an identity or a belief system that, like, transcends the game is, like, is going to be a really powerful tool. And, like, the way I'm trying to think of, like, the way that you mentioned that, you know, Rupert sort of saying that Candace is not a hero. Like, I don't think that he was doing that in a particularly persuasive way, but, like, we definitely see people do this with, you know, other identities as, like, a way to, like, I think you have this example. This is actually one of the seasons of Australian Survivor that I did see, which was the first recent season, which I think was actually the second season.
2016, but it was the third season, but it's the first of the reboot. Yeah.
But in that season, I do think that, like, there was very clearly, like, laid out, like, a kind of morality of the game, and that, like, there were certain types of, like, any sort of strategic play was seen as being very villainous, and that there was, like, this concept of mateship, and that there was, like, an honorable mm-hmm. way to play and a way that wasn't honorable. And so, like, that is a very effective way of controlling people's behavior, because once they sort of commit to that code that you've developed, they're much more likely to actually stick with you and be loyal, because they feel like they would be, you know, betraying their commitments if they didn't do that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to kind of like demonize someone, which is something that Lee did to Nick. Like, you're the snake. You're not mateship. You're too strategic. But Lee is the one who's basically at the head of the main alliance, which is ultra strategy. So Nick is being demonized as a strategic one, where like, what strategy did he have? He was like nowhere to be found, like couldn't pull off a plan. Whereas Lee is leading the strategic structure of the entire season while demonizing strategy in and of itself as it not being what, you know, the values they should uphold of the season. And I think he's I don't think he's even doing that manipulatively. Like, I definitely think someone like Boston Rob is obviously creating like the buddy system and something like that to create these values in this group and this community with like such intention. I think someone like Lee is buying into it. He doesn't even see what he's doing as strategy, even though it's strategically dominating the game. He does see it as mateship. I think he's kind of using it and buying into it at the same time. Then you take someone like Rupert. He's not using it. Like, he's bought into it the most. Like, when he's saying Candace isn't a hero, it's because the show has persuaded him how important this thing is. You know, Rupert buys into being a hero on Survivor. It's the crux of who he is as a person. It got him $1 million voted to him by the fans. And someone not behaving in that way when they've been given the honor and the title of being called a hero, that means something to him, even though it's completely meaningless. And that's him being taken in by the show, who has given him this title and made him act that way and kind of manipulated him into being that person and caring about it even more, because there was already that basis there of it being a title he really cared about, as you said. And something I wanted to say about the Davids was, like, it's interesting how it kind of becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because I think with the Davids, another thing was that not only was it like an honor to be the underdog, everyone wants to be the underdog in reality TV, but like then in the game itself, they were the underdogs, like they had the medivac first up, and they lost the challenge, and then they were down in the numbers, and they got to the merge, and they were like down in the dumps, didn't have the power, and then they mounted this like massive insurrection, like one of the most powerful battles of a minority winning that you'll ever see, where it was like the Avengers coming together with all their different advantages, winning the vote and taking back the power. And I honestly think like just that happening to work out that way with that structure where they were the underdogs and managed to like rise up in this defeat of like the big bad wolf. It just proved to them. It was like, I guess we were Davids. It wasn't something we thought about a year ago, but like now that we've been called that, we liked it and it worked out for us and it's going to be great TV. Like, I feel it. I feel it in my soul.
Yeah, no, I think it was like one of the most successful themes, like as much fun as we made of it, like at the outset. And I think that it was successful because it's like those identities are both identities that I think like they narratively fit within the game of Survivor, like just like heroes versus villains does, right? It's like in the game, there's people who are heroic that we root for, and then there's like the villains who are fun and conniving. It's like that's like a narratively relevant distinction for the game of Survivor. And so is David versus Goliath, like the underdog versus the front runner is like our favorite reality TV story to follow. But like the hustler versus the healer, like it's not a narratively like interesting distinction. But I think that's one of the reasons that definitely I think contributed to David versus Goliath being such a fun season.
And we've been talking about how to view the game in the future with these principles, how to play the game with these principles. I even think if a producer happens to be listening, I think we're narrowing in on what makes a good theme, like something that people already identify with so they can just buy into it more. Like, I think that makes a lot of sense. Like, if someone like Rupert, who's seen himself as a hero, and or even someone like Russell, who sees himself as a villain, like if you push that, like they'll take it to their extremes. Whereas like if they don't really feel like they were a no collar or white collar or a hustler or whatever, like I don't know if they can really latch onto it as much. So I feel like now we're getting into some interesting production standpoints as well.
Yeah. and the cool thing about these principles is like they explain these strategic moves, but they can explain so much because, you know, human behavior is so rich and varied, and you know, we're all these, you know, complex, beautiful snowflakes. But like getting back to how you leverage like cognitive dissonance for strategic benefit. Like, I think if you're in one of these groups, you can use those group labels as a way to, you know, reinforce identity. And if you want to cut across groups, you can sort of use that, like you can try to create dissonance in an individual by distancing themselves from that. So it's like, I don't know how much this happened, but like, I know that, you know, for example, like Dr. Allison and David versus Goliath, like she was uncomfortable, like with being labeled a Goliath because she saw herself as working really hard. And mm-hmm. I think that like Christian and Gabby, like had formed a bridge with her probably in part by saying like, hey, you're just like us. Like you're this scrappy underdog and you really earned like everything. Like I think that they like created a shared identity that was kind of like leveraging her dissonance and like the place that she was put. Like I can see doing that to some extent with like the heroes versus villains distinction, or like I think that yeah. finding a way to like
Sandra, I think like Sandra was very much like the villain's hero, I think was like kind, you know, could have been a hero as much. Like, I mean, she did dump the fish, but it was an accident. People need to get over it. And she became kind of like a proxy to the heroes, wanted to work with them. And maybe they leveraged that to a degree that she was more heroic as a villain. But then I think she leveraged it back in the final right. three to be like, I was the heroic villain. So you and all the heroes voted for her. They also hated Russell and Parvati, to be fair. But I yeah. think there was a little bit of that identity where it was like, I became heroic because I was trying to take out Russell, the ultimate villain, making me the hero. You as heroes vote for me.
Exactly. I think that that's like a really good way to understand her approach to that jury, because like, I think a lot of people have like, I've heard people at least like criticize Sandra's jury performance in Heroes versus Villains as saying like, well, all she does is set up these moves that she wanted to make that she failed at. But like, I think what she was doing was like actually, you know, connecting herself with the jury, saying like, I represented you. And I think if you like take that framing of knowing that the jury was really, really stacked with Heroes Tribes members, and that like she had kind of painted herself as being this like third option, that somebody who was the hero of the villains, is like that she was really identifying with the jury as saying like, I had the same goals that you did, and like therefore you align with me and I'm a really good alternative between Parvati and Russell.
And I think this kind of is a good segue into what we wanted to talk about, which is like cognitive dissonance in the jury and in final tribal councils, which I find really fascinating, because I feel like in terms of the jury, and I think this has been spoken about, but it's very much like jurors want to vote for the person that will make them feel best about themselves. Like they want to see themselves as, well, we'll talk about it, but like unemotional, a good player, someone who lost for like a pretty meaningless reason, not bitter. The list goes on and can be varied per person. But like, and then Sandra is a good example of that, because they saw themselves as the good guys against Russell. So voting for another good guy who was against Russell, like that puts them on like the right side of history. And like, there are so many examples of that, I feel. And I feel like this can be leveraged by finalists, something like we talked about with Sandra, but also I think it's just kind of fascinating the nature of how like jurors rationalize things to themselves when they vote.
Yeah, the jury vote is like actually, I think, just like a brilliant venue for examining cognitive dissonance, because like people are making this like very discrete choice. Like they're deciding who they want to give their vote for $1 million too, which like has real world consequences. Like I know it's like the last thing they do in the game, but like they're literally, you know, making somebody rich, and that's like a decision that they are going to have to like accept their part in. And it's like such a, like, it's like seldom do we just have like such a discrete single choice that you can analyze in that straightforward way. And people, you know, like I said, when I was talking about this principle, they're very highly motivated to believe that all of their actions are consistent with their values. So like they want to make a jury vote that is consistent with their values. And like very often there's going to be conflicting values at play when they're casting that vote. So like maybe they value, like within the game of Survivor, they value somebody who plays a really strategic game and they want to believe that they're mm-hmm. somebody who awards the win to the most deserving player. But then they also might believe that, like, they've made this friendship with somebody and that they're loyal. Like, they also might believe that, you know, that somebody's more deserving because, like, they have a family or have a certain background. So it's like they have all of this different information swimming in their head. And, like, what they have to do and ultimately what the finalist who's trying to get their vote has to do is find a way that that juror can tell themselves a story that makes all of those things line up, right? Like yeah. they have to find a way that they can feel okay that they're voting for the most deserving player, they're honoring their friendships, they're displaying their values, they're giving money to somebody who's going to use it wisely. Like they have to give each one of the jurors or whatever the majority of jurors is that they need to get the win, like a way to reconcile all of those things. And I think sometimes you see examples of like jurors who are doing a lot of work to come up with that story. But I think the best finalists are giving the jury all of the tools that they need to feel good about their decision.
Yeah. I mean, I do think we see jurors try to do a lot of that work. Like, and I actually think most people really don't want to be seen making the emotional vote. Like, I think it's valid. Like, you vote for the person you like. You vote for your friend. So many people were so hard on someone like Jeremy for voting for Nat, his real-life best friend. Like, of course he's going to do that, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that the show, even, and definitely, like, in modern times and modern fandoms, kind of put forward this idea of, like, voting for the quote-unquote best and, like, the best game and making it super logical and objective.
Right.
And I think people feel weak as jurors for making a more, what they see as like a more emotional relationship driven decision when they shouldn't. Like, small spoiler for Australian Survivor All-Stars here, if anyone wants to skip ahead 30 seconds, but in the most recent All-Star season, David won, played one of the best games of all time against Sean, who was seen as playing a much worse game. And Mo votes for Sean, which was makes so much sense. Like, they're real life best friends. They played their first season together. They've been close ever since. They know each other's families. The list goes on. When I asked Mo about it in the exit interview, she wouldn't even, like I said, like, were you the one who voted for Sean? Because we just wanted to clarify it because the show hadn't explicitly told us. Like, she would not answer the question. And I think it was because she'd been shamed so much, either internally or by the fandoms. There was a lot of shame. Like, how could you vote against, like, one of the best games ever? Are you so bitter? Like, that's another big word, bitter, emotional. People don't want to feel that way. And they will rationalize it. And I think that, and for her, I think it was a totally fine vote. But I think one of the biggest examples I've seen of rationalizing these more emotional votes to make it make sense to yourself and to still be in line with, like, logical, objective, great juror thinking, like, you're a real juror out in court making the best actual decision, which is not something that you have to do in Survivor, but people think they do, was Edge of Extinction. And then a lot of those deep dives, except for David. David was like, I voted for Chris because I liked him the best, and we were on Edge of Extinction together, and he helped me, and, like, we're friends. Like, it was emotional. Whereas I feel like everyone else was like, even like someone like Reem. Like, Reem could have said, I didn't know the others, you know, I was with Chris for weeks on end. We went through an experience no one else will know. Like, of course I voted for him, but it wasn't that. Her and Aubrey and all these people were like, he played the best and he came back and played the perfect game and Edge of Extinction is harder. And, like, I think that it was, like, rationalizing an emotional thing. And it also rationalized, like, the power of an Edge of Extinction person winning.
Yeah.
Because it's like Edge of Extinction, it's like Schrodinger's Edge of Extinction Returner. Like, until that that challenge, it could be you. So you have to spend the whole game thinking that person who could be you is so worthy of winning. And when it's not you, like, you can't go back on that. That's like the cognitive dissonance. Like, they still have to be that worthy of winning. And then you're just one challenge away from you could have won and played this awesome game. And there's a lot of logic there when I think, yeah, there's a lot of other things at play. And I think we've Edge of Extinction could be analyzed by psychologists for decades to come.
They should just show Edge of Extinction and Intro to Psych classes.
Yeah.
I think that this is, like, just such a perfect example of the power of cognitive dissonance, because, like, you've outlined so much of the argument beautifully, and it's been said before, but, like, it's not only, like, that they have to justify their jury vote, like, they also have to justify the fact that they just lived in this godforsaken place and suffered for all of these days. Like, they have to explain to themselves that that was a important, worthy thing that that was the right choice to make. And like the only way that you can justify that you made the choice, you didn't raise a sale, you stayed there the whole time, is if you believe that the edge game is worthy of awarding the win. So like these players were really like these jurors, which, you know, and of course, like all of the problems with Edge of Extinction, the jury started with Reem. So like we had all of the, like all of these people had spent all of this time. And like, I think the longer that you're there, the more dug in it had to be that your time and your suffering was worthwhile. So of course, if an Edge player gets in, you have to seriously consider giving them your their vote, and you're going to overvalue their game because it allows you to feel good about your choices and the game that you played.
Well, and that's what the thing is with, as well with cognitive dissonance is like, so if you don't vote for them or strongly consider voting for them, are you saying that you wouldn't have voted for yourself had you been in the exact same situation? And if so, why are you there? And I think a lot of people were like, the winners won't do that. They respect the game too much. And I don't think everyone would, but I think it takes a very self-assured person, even someone maybe like a David, to be like, look, I'm happy that people would have voted for me. I obviously want myself to win, but I don't think it would have been a very worthy game. I'm voting for Chris based on emotion. But that takes a lot of like self-awareness and things that I think are quite difficult. I think most people are going to have to say, you know, it was worthy for they were worthy. And as such, I would have been worthy. I think it takes a lot for someone to say it's not worthy. And as such, my experience isn't as worthy, but I still would have loved to win, and I'm still here doing it. I think someone like an Adam Klein would have been like, yeah, obviously I'm here. Obviously, if I get back, I'm asking for your votes, but like, I'm not going to say I respect Edge Extinction.
Exactly. And I think that player would have had to, like you said, had the self-awareness and then like do a lot of work on their own to justify why they decided to stay on Edge, right? Like maybe they could say like, well, I got more screen time, or, you know, I did like, but you, they would have had to do that work to make themselves feel okay about their choices. And another thing to say this about like the winter season and returnee seasons and seasons where there's like these pre-existing relationships. Like for us, we turn off the finale and then the show is over. But like for all of these people, like, you know, is Jeremy going to go home and talk to Nat every day and say like, oh, well, I voted for somebody else because like they have these existing really like they have these relationships that continue to go on. And like the winner doesn't disappear when we turn off our screen. Like they go off in the world and like have their prize money, and like all of these relationships that they have with the other players like are going to continue in some extent. So it's like whatever story you like, whatever decision you come to and whatever rationale you come up with to resolve your cognitive dissonance, it's not just for the duration of that vote. It's also for the duration of like whatever future relationship you have with that player.
Yeah. And I think Jeremy is that level of self-assured where if you were to be like, Tony played one of the best games ever, Nat came back from the edge, like, why did you vote for her? Did you really expect the edge game? Like, I think Jeremy would be like, Nat is my best friend. Like, obviously I did. But I think some other players would have to be like, yeah, it was logical. Let me explain to you why I think their game is that good. Because they just almost don't want to, A, say it to themselves, but B, say it to a fandom that can be brutal, like too brutal in terms of like, wow, how could you do that? Again, saying it to Jeremy because he voted against Tony when he and Nat are best friends. Like, it's an illogical thing from the fandom, but I think they do want to placate that because people don't want to be seen as weak, emotional, subjective, bitter, bitter's the other one, you know, like, I think an example I have is something like Eric Cardona, for example, you know, to come in and heap a lot of praise on Natalie White. Obviously, she did have a lot of positives in her game, but I think there was that kind of wanting to strip it from being an anti-Russell vote. Because A, you can see it as bitter, and B, because I just think they were kind of done with the Russell show. And like, Eric Cardona's vote was kind of Natalie's big move, so he was the right one to say it. But I think just coming in there and making it a Natalie thing instead of being, you know, heaping on the anti-Russell sentiment, takes a little bit of the power away from Russell, takes it a little bit out of the hands of Russell, and for once is like a Natalie thing. And I think everyone feels better about that. Like, don't you feel a little bit better being like, she did play great, I'm going to vote for that, instead of being like, I'm voting against you. Just feels a little better, maybe looks a little better. I think everyone kind of appreciates that when they're putting their vote through, that positive thing.
Right, right. And I think that that's an example, like we've been talking about this from the juror perspective, and like Eric Cardona, it's been a while since I watched that tribal council, but he does like one of those like grandstandy speeches, like in favor of Natalie. And like, I think that like what the jury needed probably at that point, they were all like just very poisoned against Russell. But like you said, like everybody wants like to have that story that they can point to. It's like, oh, these are the strategic things. Like these are the reasons that Natalie is a deserving winner. And I think that like Eric did a lot of the heavy lifting of making that case, at least what we saw in tribal council. But, you know, the finalist ideally is going to be the one to make that case. Like, and I think we can, and sometimes it's like, I think if you're working with dissonance, it's already there. Like, so for example, I mean, not to, you know, drudge up one of like the more controversial final tribal councils, but like where Michelle wins over Aubrey, like I think that there were a lot of players who were already disinclined to vote for Aubrey, but Michelle, I think, did do a good job of giving people a strategic rationale for voting for her over Aubrey. And it's like, I think that her path was already paved because people had, you know, were disinclined to vote for Aubrey from the jump. But I think that like, again, like just giving people a reason to justify that this isn't bitterness towards Aubrey, this is actually rewarding Michelle for a better game. It's like, that is an effective way as a finalist to manage the jury.
Yeah, I think people often like have something they really want to do and they just kind of need that little bit of rationale to like actually do it. And as a finalist, you can give them that, just kind of help them in formulating that rationalization for themselves. And I think what a big one is as well is like you, as we've said, it's how they feel about themselves, which is why they're voting. So it's how do you play into those perceptions of themselves? And one of the best examples that you offered in one of our discussions was like Cochrane answering timing as the reason that he was there and it had success, and also kind of playing into his own paranoia of why he was kind of like always on the ball. And I think that just shows how excellently you can play to people's sense of self and how they want to see themselves when they're voting. Because like no one cares about being the best at timing. No one wants to be the most paranoid. Like that's a great thing to have people be like, you're right, you were the best at those things, I'm not attached to it. If he'd been like, I won because I'm smarter than you, I'm the smartest, I think there would have been some cognitive dissonance there. Like, I don't like that. I'm not voting for that. I'm not validating that as an argument. I'm smarter than you. But they're happy to kind of let go of that one random category, which was timing. And I think that was a great answer. That way they can kind of explain their own loss. It was like, it was kind of meaningless. Why did you lose Survivor? Someone else was better at timing. Like, that's fine for everyone. And that makes them seem like they're a good player. There wasn't a lot of reason why they lost. It kind of could have been anyone, but it shaked out a different way. And like, they're happy to vote for and affirm that.
Yeah, no, it's a great example. Cause like, I think this is another thing, like as the finalist that you need to manage in the jury is that, you know, most jurors want to hold the belief that they are a good Survivor player, like that they like that there's a situation in which they could have been the winner. Right. It's like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that for some players,
well, that's a big thing from the edge as well. Like, that's what we're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that for some players, that's probably like a more deeply held belief than others. But like, I think in this example where Cochrane is answering Malcolm's question, like the tightrope that he needs to walk is he needs to like present enough to Malcolm to convince Malcolm that he played the best game and that he is a deserving winner, because Malcolm cares about awarding the win to a deserving winner. But he also has to manage Malcolm's belief that Malcolm is a really good Survivor player, right? So it's like, this is an opportunity where like he needs to show, like, he needs to convince Malcolm, I'm not better than you, but I did enough to deserve your vote. And so I think that like you can get that wrong by either not claiming enough strategic control as your own. And I do think we see players get into do this wrong where they like attribute too much to luck, but they also like, you also don't want to sort of say like, if he started to say to Malcolm, like, well, like with Malcolm's question, I think was, what do you have that I don't have? And if Cochrane was saying, I'm more strategic than you are, or I, you know, played a better game, I did this, this, and this better. I think that Malcolm's mind immediately would have gone to work dismantling Cochrane's argument there, because like that's, you know, not what he's motivated to believe. But because Cochrane gave him an answer that sort of isn't going to threaten Malcolm's sense of prowess as a survivor player, he was just able to accept that and made it really easy for him to vote for her. For Malcolm to vote for Cochrane.
Yeah, like, if so you want, like, in terms of your sense of self, like, you want to believe you're great, otherwise why did you waste all this time here? So, as you said, someone will kind of reject it if it's like, why did you win? Well, I'm so much better than you. It's like, I don't want to hear that. And then you're just rejecting the whole argument. But then, you know, as you said, you can go too far. Like, the biggest example was in Survivor South Africa Season 6, where the finalist was put it all down to luck, completely discredited all her achievements. And I think that... You kind of want to be like, I'm pretty much as good as you, but like some things went my way. Like, as you said, they often use the luck thing. I know Sandra has as well. I know Amber has used it. They often say like, basically you don't want to be so bad that they can't respect you, because then why would they vote for you? But you don't want to be, say you're so good and so much better that makes them kind of insecure in their sense themselves, and they're not even listening to you anymore, and they don't want to validate your argument in any way because it's insulting to them and how they perceive themselves. So yeah, I'm basically as good as you. You're great. I'm great. A couple of things went my way that didn't go your way. I'm lucky. I'm better at this random thing. I'm more paranoid, which worked out for me. All of these things are good. Things maybe you don't even want to have. Who wants to be paranoid? Or things that are so random. I think we should come up with, like, what would you say? Like, what did you have? It's like, I'm basically as good as you, but, like, I just have a better sense of smell. And, like, yeah. I could just kind of smell when there were idols around, and I could just kind of, smell betrayal in the air. People be like, I'm not attached to my sense of smell, so you win. That's fine.
It's sort of like the job interview question where it's like, what's your biggest weakness? And it's like, I'm a perfectionist. It's sort of like it's like coming up with this thing that's like, okay, well, that's not really
thing. Timing was great. It's a shame everyone can't use timing, but I think we could come up with more. Like, just be like, you don't want to say like, I'm smarter, I'm stronger, I'm better at challenges, I'm more strategic, I know the game more. People care about that stuff. You want to step away from what they care about. You want to say, I'm as good at those things as you are, thereabouts, maybe a little bit better at some, maybe a little bit worse at some. We're kind of on the same level, but I can't think of another one other than smell. It's going to have to be smell. I'm better at coming up with analogies. So that really helped me. It helped me see things in a different way. Cochrane really nailed it on that, I think.
Yeah, it's one of the best. I think it's one of the best individual answers for a jury member. I don't know if we're going to see this kind of like now with the new jury format. I don't feel like we see this like one juror giving a very pointed question. But I think that that's like one of the best single responses to a juror that we see. And I bet Malcolm like was probably going to give Cochrane his vote anyway there, I would guess. But it was just a really well handled question. The other example that I think of that probably a lot of people think of it's sort of in a similar line is Todd's jury response to John Robert's question, which in a similar way, I think, he found a way to answer John Robert. And I don't remember exactly what his question was. Shannon, do you happen to remember?
John Robert was like, why did you take me out? Basically, I think it was like a betrayal type thing. And Todd was very much like, because you're the best, like couldn't beat you, so have to do it. And John Robert was like, I accept that. That makes sense for my perception of myself, and thus I will not reject it.
Yeah, and I think John Robert was like very much the type of player who needed to see himself as the, you know, the smartest and the best. And so like this was something where he was like, oh, okay, you know, the best move, like Todd gave him the story that was like the best move that somebody could possibly have made in this game is recognizing that I am the greatest player, I am the biggest threat, and that I am the person to get taken out. Like that was a story that made John Robert like be able to stomach his defeat and say that Todd is going to be the most worthy player.
Yeah, like I'm great, but for you to recognize how great I am, you must also be pretty good. So you deserve
must be pretty
my vote.
Good. Yeah.
I think that's a great one. Cause as you said, so people don't want to feel emotional or bitter, but they do want to feel like a good player. They kind of want to vote for maybe often an excellent player that they can say, well, why did you lose? Well, either they were just better at a meaningless thing, like we said with Cochrane, or they're just the best. Like they are the best player. And I may be the second best player, I'm still great, but like, that's just how good they are. And I think that like, if you want to kind of get people to vote outside of like individual relationships or how they feel about someone, kind of creating that threat level, as they often talk about, like, who's going to represent their season, maybe that to a degree, but it's also just like, who beat you? They must have been pretty damn amazing to beat you. And I think like some examples of that are like Ben and Mike, not even so much as what they said, but just kind of the fact that like they'd been built up in the structure of the game for so long as these like giant powerful threats that if like you didn't get them out and you failed at that, then they were going to win. And like, it just shows that they are that great. So you must be pretty good. And also, you were so right warning them constantly that they had to take out these people. Now that they didn't, you have to prove how right you were by validating that, by affirming them as the winner. Like, if you've been warning someone for weeks and weeks that someone's going to win if you don't take them out and then don't vote for them to win and they don't win, you're wrong. So you have to prove that you're right by kind of affirming this threat level. And I think that's kind of one way to be like, voting for someone you can see is playing like the objectively biggest and best game, objectively in quotation marks, by making it like, and that means I'm great too. Who wouldn't lose to this like behemoth of the game?
So that's an interesting thing to think about with those types of end games like Ben and Mike. I'm wondering, like, do you think that there's a way that another finalist, like, so for example, like, is there a way that, with Ben's game, he's at the end with Chrissy and Ryan. Is there a way that those players could have more effectively made an argument under that circumstance? Because I was thinking that this is a little bit like the Sandra in the final three of Heroes versus Villains. Like, could those other finalists, like, could Chrissy have made the case that that she was like the representative of this group, like that Ben wasn't really deserving, like, or is it a foregone conclusion that after everybody tries to take out Ben and fails that they're going to end up giving him his vote? And like, or is there something that those alternative finalists could do better in that case to align with the jury? Because I'm thinking, like, one of the ways that they're probably threatened, the jurors are feeling threatened, is like, well, why should Chrissy and Ryan be there instead of me at the end? Like, I should have been like the last one standing that takes on Ben.
Yeah, I think that is hurtful, because I think it's like, if we were all in this objective together to get out Ben, we all failed and thus we all lost. I think it's hard to go against that and be like, well, we all failed, but somehow I'll give you the win. Like, that would feel, I think, inherently unfair. They all had a task, and in failing in that, also in saying the word fail so much, I don't think they want to vote for what they deem as a failure. I don't remember if Chrissy said this, but the argument was like, because when it was Tony, for example, Tony and Nat, Boston Rob even said, Nat, I would have voted for you if you had, like, gotten out the objective of taking out Tony. Like, that was like the task I set you and you failed, and that's why I can't reward the game. I'll vote for Tony. I think what Chrissy's like example should have been is like, so the task for me was to take out Ben. I did it. Like, I won immunity at the final four, and then like this completely unknowable, unseen, first time ever twist came in and had him win. Like, he didn't get to the end. Like, he is here, but like, I wanted my objective. He was an hour from going home. I beat him in the challenge. I did what I needed to do. We have succeeded, not as you would deem success to be, as he is sitting right next to me, but in the way that, like, this was all based on, like, some random twist that no one could see coming. Whereas, like, for Tony, he did win based on the constraints of the game that were there at the time, with fire, you know, how he got through and everything like that. Like, nothing was unforeseen. He just did make it through. So I understand Boss Rob saying, well, you didn't achieve your objective. Whereas, like, I think Chrissy should have been like, look, we fail together, we win together. We're a group against Ben, I get that. But, like, we won. We beat Ben. We did it. We couldn't help that there was this other twist that would come out of nowhere for the first time in 35 seasons. We did it. I think that would have been better. But I don't even think that would have worked.
I don't know if that would have worked, because the other thing that's working against you is I think people are, like, motivated to believe that the game was fair, because like once you start to accept the belief that this game wasn't fair, then it's like, oh well, why did I waste all this time doing it? So I think that like that's a tough sell at the final tribal council. But yeah, I would be interested to like think more about that. Like, what does a player who finds themselves in that situation with that big threat that has had like everything break right for them? Like, what do you say? And I think that like that they probably would have had to. I don't know what they would have had to come up. Like, I think that they would have had to come,
especially because they didn't really like Chrissy as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I guess the question for me is like, was this a bad execution, or was Chrissy really in an impossible situation? But like, again, like, could you find a way to both flatter the jury and give them enough of a reason to vote for you? And I think that that's what everybody like tries to do. They try to sell that like the game that they like, the more traditional strategic and social game, is more worthy of a win than like the flashy twisty based game. That's definitely the pitch that they try to make. But for whatever reason, like, maybe there's a way to better flatter the jury in that, like, to say something like, you know, to say like, you know, well, Devin, if you got it to the end, you would definitely have won. Or to say something like, you know, to say that maybe, you know, Ashley, you were the best player of the season. Like, maybe like to kind of like lift up the games that they played as like, if you couldn't be here taking on Ben, like, then I'm just doing my best to show. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe there's some way to do that. But it's a really, really tough position to be in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in, like, the psychological assessment of the jury. Like, these are people who are not in the game anymore. Like, they are irrelevant, but reality TV contestants and people in general don't like to feel like that. And their one thing is, like, their speech or, you know, Final Trouble Council and their vote, and, like, they're going to make it as impactful as possible. And even just, like, the psychology of how Kelly Wentworth apparently was great at even, like, winking to the jury, or even, like, mentioning the jury in Final Trouble Council, or the psychology of the fact that idols mean more than immunity wins because it happens in front of the jury, and things that they see kind of having more weight and more impact because it like explicitly involves them. I think it is quite a big deal. I just think in that situation with Chrissy, it's a hard one because it's kind of like the opposite of the Edge of Extinction thing. The Edge of Extinction thing is like, we're the same. We were a group. We were a team. I happened to win the challenge. You might have been 1 minute behind me in the challenge. So if I win, it's like you basically won. Like, we were 1 minute in a challenge from winning. Whereas like with the Chrissy thing, I think it's like we as a group failed together.
And I actively voted you out because I wanted to sit next to Ben instead of you sitting next to Ben. So it's like, it's different from winning a single challenge. It's also like Chrissy was in many ways like the, you know, involved in all of their ousters. So I think that makes it more complicated too. But yeah, it's interesting. It is like a reverse Edge of Extinction phenomenon. And also like, unlike Edge, it's like, it's not like getting back into the game. It's this one threat, like this one, it's this one person who's like everybody's intensely focused on, and it sort of would undermine like what their focus was for the entire game if they don't like then uphold his threat level by awarding him the win.
I think it's basically like, look, this was a colossal failure. If you had been here, possibly it wouldn't have been, maybe you would have beaten him in fire, like, who knows. I'm sure you would have sorted this out yourself. I didn't, so I failed, so I'll lose. Like, it's a really tough one for someone there when someone's been hyped up as a threat so hard. And like, Ben was hyped up because it was like you couldn't get rid of him, but like they could have, but they didn't due to a twist and no one knew coming, and it was coming, and it was still that impactful. I think that's a really hard one. I don't know. I think that was pretty much
that's probably why it's so frustrating for the viewers and like to watch that, because it's like it does seem like those other finalists are really in an impossible situation.
Yeah. I find it really interesting. I feel like we've gotten to a lot of interesting things in this podcast, talked a lot about jet skis. The one example actually I didn't bring up in terms of like, this is what I actually loved about the jet ski thing, is like when you take out the swing vote, like obviously like Rob did against like Chrissy Smith, I was thinking about that and I loved it because I was like, your jet ski is taking out each other, like your primary objective is to take out each other, but like that's door in the face, which is I guess somehow impossible, so you'll come down to the more reasonable option of like a vote you don't want as much but you get to see tomorrow. And I just kind of love the idea of like you being each other's, like, I kind of feel like it's like the Spider-Man meme where you're pointing at each other, but you're both gestures.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's, it's really good. Cause if, like, you think about it, like with the jet ski, like metaphor, it's like, you know, what you really want is like a laptop, a new laptop or whatever. It's like, this
yes,
is
exactly.
What you really want, like the reasonable thing is like, I just want to stay in the game, like another
yeah,
day.
Exactly.
It's like, I'll settle, like, that's totally fine. I'll settle for that for Christmas or Hanukkah this year. But like, I'll start by saying I would love to like take out the other alliance, and then they, you know, turn and go on the swing vote. And of course, we should never like miss an opportunity to praise the great Rob Sesternino, who did that, who pioneered that move. But that's a really good one.
I mean, voting out the swing vote in general, I think I've said on podcast before, it's like one of my absolute favorite moves, because it's just like someone goes from being in the like the highest position of power and like there's pretty much no further to fall. I mean, yeah, it definitely works for this, because you might say, well, I'm not going to vote for that person. Like if that was the first thing presented to you, you'd say like, they might work with me, I'm not doing that. But when the other thing presented to you is like much bigger, much harder, might not work out, you might go home, you're like, okay, I'll settle for this other move. There's a lot of really interesting stuff to hear. I hope the listeners got something out of it, because I feel like I definitely do, and I see the game quite differently.
Well, this was super fun to talk about. Like, I think that we came up with some really, really good examples of this, and and I do think that, like, in addition to just sort of describing some of the things that we see, I definitely think that there's like nuggets in here for somebody who is going to play Survivor, or play like another type of similar game, to you know, to learn how to use some of these things to their advantage,
manipulate their loved ones for sure.
Yeah. Get that jet ski you've been waiting for.
But to get ski, you'd have to ask for something even, what is bigger than a boat? Would you ask for a boat?
Ask for like a helicopter or a boat?
Actually get that jet ski, which as we know is Boston Rob. We've gone around in circles at this point. But Amanda, where can people check out what you're doing? Where can they follow what you're doing in the podcast world?
Well, people should definitely follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Amanda R. That's D-R Amanda R. And you can check me out on the most recent episode of RENAP, where I was talking about something equally as scientific and interesting, the my size versus intelligence theory of how gross an animal is.
Okay. I saw a graph on that and I didn't understand.
I have a whole PowerPoint. I can send it to you if you don't have time to listen to the podcast. But also please do check me out with Jason Curtis Rivera. We're recapping every episode of Psych. We're on number 11, and you can find us at ikydk.com. That stands for I Know You Don't Know.
Interesting. Well, in terms of what I'm doing on the podcast, I want to tell everyone to watch the first two episodes of Survivor South Africa Season 5, because Mike Bloom and I are starting our podcast series next week where we watch that. I have never seen it, so it's totally spoiler-free. Mike has seen it, but it was after he just had a baby. I don't know why it was like his initial instinct was like to watch that season when he had a baby, but so he like doesn't remember any of it. So it's spoiler-free. It's going to be a lot of fun. Everyone should join us on that. You can follow me at Shannon Gates on Instagram and Twitter. But this has been so much fun, Amanda. I really feel like we got so much. I feel like my brain is now like firing. I feel like I love like getting into the stuff, and then I feel really smart. Like I'm just a Survivor podcaster and it's nothing impressive, but then I feel intellectual and I feel like it's fun. Like as much as we want to help people be good in the game in the future, as much as we want to help people analyze it, also mostly game theory is super fun and that's why we do this.
It's super fun. This has like been such a great series too. I've listened to your other podcasts, so I feel like my brain is also getting bigger by talking to you, Shannon. This has been a total blast.
It's been so much fun. Thank you so much for being here. And I also wanted to say, like, we've got some really fun stuff in the pipeline with the Game Theory series, but if anyone has any ideas, we've already got some good suggestions that we're going to do. But if you have any ideas of what you want us to talk about, always feel free to pitch it to me or DM me, and I would be happy to look at it, and maybe we'll even do it. So please do reach out. But thank you so much again, Amanda. Thank you to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Thank you to all you guys for listening, and we will see you next time. Bye.
Australian Survivor.
Survivor
New Zealand.
Survivor.
Survivor.
21 South Africans.
12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
Give them the swimmer.
£1 million.
Million euro.
Million.
Million.
Rubli.
Transport.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.